If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, the Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
British summertime is finally here, and we want you to make the most of it by getting to know more of the history you love with a subscription to BBC History Magazine. Subscribe this summer and get 6 issues for just £24.99, saving 30% on the shop price. Plus, when you sign up, you will also receive a book of your choice from Russia, Revolution and Civil War, 1917 to 1921 by Anthony Beaver, In Search of the Dark Ages by Michael Wood, signed edition, or In Search of Mary Seacole, The Making of a Cultural Icon by Helen Rappaport, signed edition. To take advantage of this offer and for more information, visit www.buysubscriptions.com/summerreads2022. Offer ends on the 5th of August 2022. Offer only available to UK residents. Please visit website for terms and conditions.
And welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Reveal. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. 2022 is the History Extra podcast's 15th birthday. So to mark 15 years of fascinating historical conversations, we've asked 15 historians to nominate a figure from history who they think deserves their 15 minutes of fame. Some are inspiring people who deserve more airtime today. Others are those whose significance in history has been overlooked. And some simply led fascinating and unexpected lives. Our guest for today's episode is Dr. Mark Morris. Speaking to Emily Briffitt, Mark reveals why he's nominated St. Wilfrid, an early medieval saint and religious church reformer.
Hi, Mark. It's lovely to be chatting to you today.
It's great to be on.
So you've chosen to nominate St. Wilfrid. Can you briefly explain who Wilfrid was and when are we talking about here?
Wilfrid was Bishop of Northumbria in the first instance. He was also Bishop of other places. And we are talking about the 7th century for the most part, but he lived such a long and interesting life that he shuffles on into the early 8th century.
So this was a significant amount of time ago. How has Wilfrid's story come down to us through history?
Well, we're very fortunate with Wilfrid. I mean, we're talking about in the, to give it a little bit more context, we're talking about the 7th century is a crucial century in terms of the Christianisation of Britain, in particular, the Christianisation of the Anglo-Saxons. That's a period when, for the first time, really, we get much fuller written sources, because prior to that point, prior to the advent of Christianity, these people had been pagans and as such, largely illiterate. So suddenly we have Bede. He's one way in which the story of the conversion as a whole comes down to us. Bede is writing in the early 8th century, 730s. So he tells some of Wilfrid's story, but even better in a way, Wilfrid is the subject of a contemporary biography. You would call it a saint's life, but it's really unlike other saints' lives in that it's so political and so polemical that hagiography doesn't really begin to cover it. It's like a propaganda piece, because Wilfrid's life and Wilfrid himself, he was such a controversial and larger-than-life character that clearly his acolytes, after he was dead, felt the need to defend his reputation. So pretty much uniquely, I think, of all the characters featured in Bede, we have this counterpoint to Bede in the shape of the life of Wilfrid. So that they're the two sources that tell us what Wilfrid was about.
I want to come back to this idea of him being slightly controversial later, but you're talking about this being a significant time in terms of medieval Christianity. Where did Wilfrid exactly fit into this picture?
Well, as I say, Wilfrid is Bishop of Northumbria when he's in his 30s, but he's born in Northumbria in, I think we can sort of narrow the date down to 634, so the fourth decade of the 7th century. And at that time, Northumbria is, and the rest of what later becomes England is, as I say, largely pagan. Conversion has only been going since the late 6th century, and in Northumbria, only for a few years. So he's born into a world which is largely pagan. In terms of his social status, he's not royal, but he's sufficiently well connected that he ends up at the royal court. So he's obviously the son of some vaguely well-to-do family. And he ends up at the court of the kings of Northumbria. And he is then sort of sent out to live on Lindisfarne, which is the cradle of Christianity in the north. Again, I mean, Lindisfarne had only been founded around the time of Wilfrid's birth. And as a teenager, he's sent out there really as a helpmeet to a disabled monk. And he quickly tires of that. He's clearly a man of huge intelligence, as the rest of his career proves. And he desires to go to Rome. He obviously, you know, he's reading, Christian texts. He's reading Christian fathers, and clearly feels that the centre of the universe, as far as he's concerned, is going to be Rome. So he sets off in his late teens, all the way south to Kent, and after a pit stop in Kent, he ends up in southern Francia, and eventually he goes to Rome. So that's really the turning point of his life, or the great kind of revelation in his life, is he sees Rome. And if you've come from Northumbria, or indeed anywhere in Britain in the 7th century, you've never seen a community of more than a few hundred people. There are no towns to speak of in that period. And then all of a sudden, he's in a city which, whilst nothing compared to its imperial heyday, when millions of people roamed the streets of Rome, there's probably over 100,000 people still in Rome. So it must have just been mind-blowing. And of course, there's all the Roman architecture, which some of which still stands today, like the Colosseum or the Trajan's Column. But that would have been, you know, those things were still there in the 7th century, obviously, and a whole heap more. So it's a mind-blowing experience. And he comes back to Britain completely converted to the Roman idea of what Christianity should be. And that sets him at loggerheads with the tradition in which he's been raised, which is the Celtic tradition, the Irish tradition on Lindisfarne, and all kinds of fireworks therefore ensue.
From this point of Wilfrid returning from Rome, what were some of the headline events of his life?
Well, I mean, from that point, so the main headline event, the place where he first comes to prominence, is the Synod of Whitby, which is a victory for the Roman Church, in that that Oswy says, well, we have to go with Rome. And according to his biographer, he's called Stephen of Ripon, who writes the life of Wilfrid, Wilfrid is a kind of model of eloquence and politeness, and according to Bede, he's kind of clearly very rude and abrasive, and sort of dismisses the Celtic Church as kind of simpletons who are sort of like, you know, he says at one point, you know, the rest of the world follows this Roman tradition, and you're just kind of people from a small island, a dot in the sea, you know. So that brings him to kind of public prominence. Soon after that, a few years after that, he eventually becomes Bishop of Northumbria. But then his career from then on, which, as I say, lasts a very long time, it's absolutely crammed with incident because of his personality and because of the way he thinks what he thinks a bishop should do, i.e. exercise great power. He keeps rubbing up against and falling foul of secular rulers. So he is very pally with Oswy's successor, a king of Northumbria called Edgefrith, at the start of his reign. And when Edgefrith is kind of conquering lands from the Picts to the north and the Britons to the west, Wilfrid is there kind of cheering him on and saying, "You're doing good, you know, God's work here. And, you know, look at how kind of pleased God will be with all the land you've got at sword point." But then he falls out with Edgefrith. He falls out with Edgefrith's new queen. His queen, quite rightly, she points out that, Wilfrid has all this power and all these retainers and, all, you know, just it's just a sort of a rival, really. So he ends up in, he eventually ends up in Sussex, which is still pagan. He becomes Bishop of Sussex. He converts thousands of people in Sussex. After the Archbishop of Canterbury dies, Archbishop of Canterbury Theodore, who'd been instrumental in removing him from Northumbria, he goes back to Northumbria. And this is again after Edgefrith's death. So there is a new Northumbrian king on the throne with whom Wilfrid quickly falls out again. So he ends up on two occasions going back to Rome to plead his case. So he's clearly Northumbria is where his heart lies. But his life is crammed with incident. And it's all the politics that makes him so different to other famous Anglo-Saxon saints. I mean, I have to confess, the reason I nominated Wilfrid was because I hadn't heard of him until I started researching this Anglo-Saxon's book. I had heard of other more conventionally pious Northumbrian saints like Aidan and like Cuthbert. And when you compare Wilfrid with Cuthbert, you know, Cuthbert is kind of like, you know, he's kind to children and animals, and he, you know, doesn't do very much and meanders round from village to village on foot, converting and having a fairly conventional, what you would think of as a conventional saint's life. And Wilfrid, by contrast, is all over the place. He's in Wessex, he's in Mercia, he's in East Anglia, he's in Kent, he's in Rome, he's fighting on the beaches with pagans, you know, he's engineering coups. So he's a fantastic, his life, his long life is a fantastic way to navigate the tumultuous events that are going on in both Britain and Francia and Rome during this period, this crucial period of conversion.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
He moves from one polity to the other, one Anglo-Saxon kingdom to the other, and very quickly pals up with the powerful people. So he's clearly enormously charismatic and influential.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Spring is a time of renewal, so why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Free samples, free shipping, and our 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step and into your home too. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
From quite an unconventional life. How did Wilfrid actually come to be canonised as a saint?
Well, the process of being canonised as a saint, as I understand it, in the sort of 7th, 8th, 9th centuries, is not nearly so rigorous as it becomes in the later Middle Ages. So you become a saint simply, I think, by popular acclamation, and people saying there were miracles worked after his death. He lived a devout and religious life, and so... Sainthood is not sort of centrally controlled. I think I'm right in saying that. That's certainly the case as late as the Norman Conquest, another subject to which I know a little bit about. And that's something that really strikes the Normans when they take over in 1066. They have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of old English saints, and they look at their kind of saints' lives, or they listen to the traditions that are handed down by their English colleagues. And they say, I'm not entirely sure this guy qualifies as a saint or this woman qualifies as a saint. So I think there were clearly people at the time with Wilfrid who felt that his behaviour was less than saintly. Like a lot of people who have these controversial careers, there were clearly people who thought Wilfrid was just absolutely the business, you know, that he was exactly what a bishop should be. And he, as I say, he dies... in the early 8th century, surrounded by adoring acolytes. And he's clearly achieved a great deal. The life of St. Wilfrid is such a partisan source that one cannot help react against it and think, come off it. This is so obviously propaganda. It makes you think worse of him because it's trying so hard to tell you how wonderful he was. So, for example, it says, you know, he never drank more than a glass of wine. And anyone who says so is clearly not telling the truth. And we can produce many witnesses that will affirm this. And you think, clearly lots of people must have been going around saying Wilfrid was a terrible old lush, you know. So it is a source that you react to. Having said that, his achievements were huge. I mean, he is the guy who, you know, sort of wrests Northumbria from the Celtic tradition to the Roman tradition. He's the guy who converts loads of people in Sussex. And he's clearly a sort of seductive voice in the ear of powerful laymen, because he not only sort of he moves from one polity to the other, one Anglo-Saxon kingdom to the other, and very quickly pals up with the powerful people. So he's clearly enormously charismatic and influential, and does drive a great deal of change. And probably the conversion process itself would have been slower without Wilfrid and other men like him. But at the same time, lots of people suffer as a result of his rise and his kind of intransigence, you know, that his belief that he is right and there is only one way to do this, and it doesn't matter who gets flattened in the process. So I think a very, very interesting and as I say, little known figure, possibly because he dies in his bed. I mean, he dies, as I say, as an old man in his mid-70s, surrounded by adoring acolytes. And had he been martyred as a result of his many clashes with many different kings, had any one of those ended in a Thomas Becket-style martyrdom, I'm sure he'd be a lot more famous. So it's kind of almost ironic with the fact that he goes on so long and achieves so much, mainly to the fact that he's now largely forgotten.
What would you say is Wilfrid's legacy?
If you ask Wilfrid himself, or let's look at what Wilfrid's own biographer says, he was clearly, his major achievement, he thought, was correcting the English church, or in the first instance the Northumbrian church, but by extension the wider English church, correcting what he came to see as the heresy of following the Irish or Celtic tradition. Because that is writ large in his biography, which is, as I say, written after his death. And the one thing that keeps being trotted out whenever Wilfrid's many accusers come at him. And of course, we're never really told what Wilfrid's crimes actually are, what his own faults are, because they're airbrushed out of his biography. They were just told that anyone who accused him was just lying and wasn't to be believed, you know. But what's always trotted out in his defence is, look at his achievement. I've got a bit of the biography in front of me, and he says, "Did I not convert the whole Northumbrian nation to celebrating Easter at the proper time, as the Holy See demanded, and having the proper Roman tonsure in the form of a crown instead of the old way of shaving the back of the head? Did I not teach you to chant according to the practice of the early church with two choirs, etc., etc.? Did I not bring monastic life into line with the rule of St. Benedict, never before introduced to these parts? And have I not..." And so he goes on, you know, and these are all things that he felt on his, you know, from the time he was in his late teens, he thought, this is the proper way to do it. This is the way God wants it to be done. And we are steeped in error in Northumbria and you know, in other parts, in other Anglo-Saxon kingdoms. So he saw that as his great achievement. And I think, you know, that's something you can't take away from him, because, you know, the Roman Church was ultimately the victor in that ideological struggle. But I think at the time, that, you know, the other thing that's very evident from his biography is lots of people were very sore about Wilfrid. He made lots of enemies, and he led forced conversions, and he really didn't care who got squashed in his kind of, you know, drive to bring this change about. So it's very, I think there's a very useful actually eulogy in Bede. Bede, who was kind of lukewarm on Wilfrid. He kind of, you know, I think he had the measure of him and recognised his achievements, but recognised that he put a lot of people's noses out of joint. And Bede talks about, it's not Bede's own eulogy, Bede has the inscription on Wilfrid's tomb, which, as I remember, was kind of conventional, but it describes him as Wilfrid Magnus, Wilfrid the Great. And I think that's a very useful word from our point of view, because his impact was undoubtedly great. He is arguably the most important individual in terms of the conversion of the Anglo-Saxons, arguably more important than even someone like Archbishop Theodore or even St. Augustine, in terms of the length of his life and his impact. But great doesn't necessarily mean good, does it? Great can just mean massive impact. So I think great is a useful word for a man like Wilfrid.
My final question for you then is, why do you personally think that Wilfrid deserves his 15 minutes of fame?
Well, I think at the risk of repeating myself, it's because his impact is so huge. And because I hope this isn't just me, but as I say, I've been doing medieval history for a fair chunk of my life now, about half my life, or maybe more, gosh. And I, you know, I knew about lots of characters in the pre-conquest period. If you know, someone like Alfred or King Offa or even Athelflaed, Lady of the Mercians, or Emma of Normandy, whoever these figures were, if I didn't know their story inside out, at least heard of them, I had the rough idea of what was going on, you know. In the case of Wilfrid, I couldn't have picked him out of a lineup of Anglo-Saxon saints, you know, for any amount of money. He wasn't really a name to conjure with. And as I say, I could have done that. I could have easily told you a little bit about Dunstan or a little bit about Cuthbert, because they are better known. And yet, as soon as I kind of read the life of Wilfrid, I thought, this guy's life is phenomenal. And he sort of travelled the, you know, the known world, and he argued with almost everybody in it. And he wrought such enormous change. And I think, you know, that's what's interesting to me. I mean, it's what's very useful as an author. It's great for individuals at the time if they're pious and God-fearing. But if they don't do very much, then they're not going to serve your story as an author. Someone like Wilfrid, who is just relentless and constantly on the move and constantly clashing with other people, is a real gift to an author who needs to cover that same territory himself or cover that same narrative. So for all those reasons, I would give Wilfrid more due, you know, and that's why I thought I'd nominate him for his 15 minutes.
That was Dr. Mark Morris speaking to Emily Briffitt. Mark is a historian and author whose most recent book is The Anglo-Saxons, A History of the Beginnings of England. If you're enjoying this series and would like early access to more episodes to hear more historians nominating people who deserve their 15 minutes of fame, go to historyextra.com/15-minutes. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Daniel Kramer Arden.